Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of They Had to Go Out podcast. Thanks everybody for joining us. Thank you for all of our new YouTube subscribers. Every episode that we can record live, we're putting up there now. And then as always, you can listen to the audio on your favorite podcast platform. But thank you all for doing that.
Yeah, everybody, welcome. If it's your first time, we're really glad to have you. As always, you picked a good one. I know I say that every time, but we seem to keep getting better and better guests. Hopefully that'll continue. Once you like what you've heard, please go subscribe. Subscribe to us on the podcast app. Subscribe to us on YouTube. We're going to get as much stuff up there as we can. Follow us on Instagram. Tell us what you'd like to see more of. Tell us what you didn't like. But hopefully there's not much you didn't like.
Fair enough. Hey, I really think you guys are going to dig this one today. We've got a heck of a guest on, and when I talked to him this morning to kind of confirm time, he actually told me that he was going to go up in an airplane and jump out of it a couple of times and on a new drop zone he hadn't been to before. So very interesting dude with a very varied career, and I think a lot of insight into some good stuff. But who we've got on the line? Mr. Chris Costa, born in New Bedford, Massachusetts, grew up in St. Petersburg, Florida. Dad was a Coast Guard veteran himself. Chris joined the Coast Guard back in 1992 at 17 years old. Started out with probably recruit company Delta 141 is what he's thinking. Came out of there as a fireman. Got to Station Pensacola, but needs of the service took him to Coast Guard Cutter Saginaw, an Aton unit. From there, he tried to mutual out, but they wouldn't let him out of the 8th Navigation Community. Ended up in an ant team in Pensacola. Eventually, though, was able to make it to Tacklet North, where he started a almost decade-long career in tactical law enforcement, going from Tacklet North to the Maritime Law Enforcement Academy in Yorktown, and then to the International Training Division. In 2003, completed his tour of duty and moved into the civilian sector. And that's where things got really interesting, I think. But I'm going to let Bill ask the question.
We'll concentrate on the Coast Guard career for now, right?
Right.
All right, Chris, welcome. And the question, as always, what's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
Man, I don't know. I'll tell you, every now and then, people ask me if I missed a life, and I don't know how you don't, especially when you get a good crew. You know, you get a good skipper, you get a good command. I don't know how you don't miss it every day. But the Coast Guard was tasked with a really interesting mission, and the the mission took part in South Padre Island, Texas, which is a little kind of a weird location, especially when we're like tackle it guys, and most of what we do is either Caribbean and or Persian Gulf and Adriatic and everywhere else. The mission entailed us to go to Army Air Assault School. We did everything but the rigging. So basically all the normal helo stuff, everything, you know, as far as how do you set up when you hit the beach somewhere. And that was kind of the quick version of that.
Dude, you got to tell me, so Chris, what is Air Assault School? Like, I don't even know. That's completely out of my...
Army Air Assault School, if you go through the full school, it has to do everything with tactics coming out of the helicopter along with the rigging portion. So it's a really important school because you're always in and around helicopters. You're talking about weights and different stuff. And there was some stuff that didn't really apply to the mission that we were doing. But one of the things that is unique about the Coast Guard is that we may not have the schools because we're the Coast Guard, right? So we're just not built that way. I mean, at the time I was in, there were 35,000 New York police officers, and we had less people in the United States Coast Guard than there were as New York City cops. So a lot of times, especially when we were at Tacklet, we were always farmed out to schools. So if we were import, generally we're running to Beretta School, we're running to NSG Northwest out of Chesapeake, which was run by the Marine Corps, we're running the Portsmouth TRU unit schools, a lot of shooting schools and a lot of outside military schools that you wouldn't normally find Coast Guard in. And in fact, when we did show up, we were always kind of getting looked at like, what are these guys doing here?
Yeah, right.
Who are you and why are you here?
Yeah, and you know, that's always the funny thing when I talk to people and I'm like, oh, I was in Albania, or yeah, I was in Republic of Georgia, and they're like, when was that? And I was like, oh, when I was in the Coast Guard. And they're like, what do you mean you were over there? And I'm like, well, you know, we had certain units that deployed over there to do certain missions. It's the funny thing is we don't write books, so therefore nobody knows. You know what I'm saying? And most of us, and then the odd part about the Coast Guard is I find that most of us, when we get out, that's it. Like, we go back to, like, just being normal people and doing other things. Nobody, very rarely do does people stay in this kind of community that they came out of, which I think is why there's such an unknown about the Coast Guard. Because everybody just goes, I remember skippers where I was like, oh, what are you going to do when you retire? Because it's the last boat. And they're like, I'm going to go back to my farm in Indiana. And I'm like, what?
Like, right.
You're going to go from maritime to farming? That makes no logical sense. But I find everybody goes their separate ways. And it's one of these tales that never get told because, well, we're not trying to be like the guys who killed Bin Laden. You know what I'm saying? At the end of the day, like, we do our thing. We're really good at what we do. I love when people try to demean us as if we're doing less than what we're doing. It's like, well, we have a certain mission. We do it. We're really freaking good at it. And we do it all the time. And we're not trying to compare ourselves to other individuals that are amazing at their job descriptions within a special operations community or whatever. So, I always find that there's like such a disconnect between the reality of what people think the Coast Guard does and what the Coast Guard does.
For sure, man. I think that's a great way to put it. I think there's just got to be some mutual respect all around for what unique jobs that people do.
Absolutely. So we went to Army Air Assault School and a lot of other shooting schools to prepare for this operation. And basically what was happening in a nutshell was Station Padre Island was dealing with the Mexicans and them running drugs and narcotics 24/7.
Right, and South Padre is like, it's all the way at the southern end of the state too. So, I mean, it is the border essentially.
Yeah, you're pretty much on the border there, yeah.
You are, absolutely. And what happened was, you know, you figure, you know, we're running, you know, at that time, you know, you figure the station's got some 41s down there. They have some non-standard ribs and stuff. And these guys are running these gutted out wooden boats that you can't even really pick up on radar. you're right. better off running thermal because you'll pick up the human beings vice the boat. And there are these gutted out wooden boats that are running like a 200 horsepower Yammerhammer with a tiller. So when these guys go to maneuver, that boat turns quick, and they're more set up for running in the surf. So now you get this RHI and you get this cockpit, you're going to worry about his crew, and you know they couldn't follow these guys into the beach. And generally, what would happen is either a Bronco or a Suburban would be literally taillights backed up, and within 3 minutes, they'd offload a ton of cocaine or marijuana. Gone. And then that hits Brownsville and every other road out of, you know, Texas area heading north. So the station was really being overwhelmed. So they set up this big operation where they brought in guys that people, unless they're old, they won't remember like Operation Opbat, which was like Bahamas, Turks and Caicos. And the Coast Guard always had Coast Guard guy, customs guy, DEA guy, and a few other individuals on board helicopter. And they would do the same kind of thing we were doing, but for this operation called Operation Opbat. So we got the pilots from Opbat that were going to be flying H-60s, and then we were thrown into the helicopter. All the tacklet guys were in the helicopters with what they called the Texas Corps, which worked solely for the state of Texas, the governor. And this was a really interesting unit because a lot of guys were actually ex-special operations guys. This unit was designed to go into a town and start doing drug buys and other things, and then work with the police so that the police busted everybody, even these guys. And then, of course, then the guys would get let out of jail and they go over and, you know, do this into the next town. So we had Texas Corps with us on the helicopters. We had Border Patrol, DEA, Customs with the ground units, along with other Coast Guard riding with Border Patrol. So you're talking about Coast Guard guys doing vehicle stops with Border Patrol and doing that quote unquote Border Patrol mission. So, I mean, I would say
authority available there. There's everybody's got jurisdiction of something at that
point. I was going to say, you pretty much have jurisdiction completely covered. Army National Guard, they were down on the beaches as like fishermen, running thermal and everything for us. Like, they were the main eyes and ears. I don't know what their unit was called, but they were the main eyes and ears that pretty much directed most of us to the targets.
Okay.
And at that point, I mean, we, the Coast Guard, this wasn't a normal mission for us. I mean, we're wearing, you know, full kitted out vests, we're wearing leg rigs, we're wearing baklavas. They don't even want people to see our face. The SOP was, hey, we don't want any civilians to see you guys coming out of that helicopter. So, you know, we were like, okay, well, most of this is going to take place back in South Padre Island. You pretty much had about 12 to 15 miles of beach that wasn't built up. You had the hotels where spring break and everything happened. Now, mind you, this literally was going on during spring break.
Terrible deployment. Terrible deployment for you, Chris.
Horrible.
Yeah.
I graduated high school when I was 17, went right into the military. So my parents were like, hey, we'll pay for college. But I hated school. I loved some classes and some teachers, and the rest of school I just couldn't stand. So I went into the Coast Guard, and I didn't get that college thing, right? So now here I am at spring break, and I'm like, oh, I wonder what spring break's like. And it is literally crazy. You would walk by rooms, and it was like, must have been 50 cases of beer stacked alongside the walls, and most doors were open. Now, mind you, we're in civilian clothes, and we're sitting there with like these two huge green bags and Pelican kits as we're on the elevator getting off and going back to our room. Now, the good news was we operated at night out of Cameron County Airport. We had a SKU-3, which I guess, if I remember correctly, that was like a kind of crypto sat phone that talked to Corpus Christi. And luckily, since we worked nights, when we came back and passed out, the hotel was quiet. until about two or three. So we would sleep, and then of course, then it was just ridiculous, you know, watching people do like three-story beer bongs and everything. And
did you get in on some of that action, Chris?
No, we did not.
No three-story beer bongs
schedule.
Yeah, right.
We had about 8 days on, and then you had like either 1 or 2 days off if you were lucky, because we would rotate, I think, 2 days in a helicopter if we were called, and then 1 day with Border Patrol doing vehicle stops, and then 2 days in a helicopter. And it was a little bit before we get some liberty, but we were doing such a kick-ass mission, like none of us cared.
Right.
We're just like, yeah, this is awesome. How many times do you get to jump out of a helicopter and take drug dealers down on a beach as it's happening? So,
how many people were on the team?
Well, we ran Tacklet North started at first, and then after we were really successful down there, Tacklet South came up, and then I think they finished it out. There was a time limit on this operation to get a kind of a round turn going on, I don't know how many Tacklet teams were down there. I would say, because we still had some in the Caribbean. Plus, we did the Olympics, too, in 96, and I think this was a little bit after. So we were, like, there are a lot of teams. We had a lot of teams out. But I would say there was at least three teams down there. I think there were three teams down there, so you're figuring, what, seven guys? I would say that's about right. There's probably three-ish teams down there, with probably two still in the Caribbean and or the Persian Gulf or wherever else.
Yeah, so like 20 guys, give or take, down at the same time, just splitting the duty.
True.
Yeah,
absolutely. And then every night we would meet at South Padre Island. We would meet the DEA guys, whoever's working that night, because they had their own crew of guys and customs. And everybody was to have IR chems marked on their trucks so that the pilots. So our biggest deal was what we were for was if customs or DEA or somebody was out on a beach and spotted these guys because they were outnumbered and probably outgunned at that point, they would call OpCon. OpCon would call us at Cameron County, and we were pretty much 15 minutes away. And the pilots were really cool because you know how pilots take, you know, like 15 minutes just to do pre-flight. So when the pilots land, like we didn't have time for pre-flights. You know, like pre-flight is, and the guy is literally in Oklahoma now. So the pilots were super awesome. They were used to it. I mean, it wasn't their first rodeo. We had a guy named Chopper Bob. He was ex-Vietnam door gunner pilot. So like this guy, you know what I'm saying? Like, I will say this, the Coast Guard really changed when we got rid of our Vietnam era guys. And then we got this batch of kinder, gentler officers that were risk aversioners. And I love officers. I'm not one of those like enlisted guys that's like anti-officers. I have officers that are, you know, to this day, I hold in extremely high regard, but the Vietnam era guys got out and there was a void for a while. I can't tell you how the Coast Guard is now. I'm just saying that like when the Vietnam era guys were in there, it was like, get the job done. Going to give a crap what it takes. And if you think about the Coast Guard's motto, it was back in the life-saving days, you have to go out, but you don't have to come back. Nowadays they're like, dude, we don't know if you should go out and you better not break the boat. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I remember my dad rolling boats at Cape Disappointment because that's what the instructors wanted them to do. Not like, oh, if you roll the boat, you know, you're in trouble. It was like, hey, there was a block of instruction where like, we want you to roll the boat and go through the experience. I'm like, I guarantee it's probably not taught that way at Cape Disappointment now, which it's just sad, you know, so the definite changes. So we had a really good helicopter crew. And the guys at the deck were just stellar athletes. So
dude, you just made me so nostalgic with that like the last 30 seconds of this interview were just made me nostalgic. I mean, that's where I'm at.
You're so old, Phil.
I know, man. I couldn't help it. I didn't get to roll boats at Cape D, but you know what he's talking about. Come on.
Oh, I know exactly what he's talking about. I was thinking, like, I've worked with some helicopter crews, and what we're starting to see now, Chris, is guys who've transferred, who have experience in Iraq and Afghanistan and have come over to us from the Army because they realize the life's better over here. And we're starting to kind of get that mentality back, at least on the helicopter side of the house. I've worked with some guys who were, you know, legit combat vets. So what we're doing, they're kind of like, oh, nobody's shooting at me? This is nothing. Let's go.
Yeah, and you bring up a really interesting situation. So day two, one of the deaths is in the air, and Border Patrol's in pursuit on their own boat, because they have boats too, of a Mexican shark boat that decides to turn around and hightail it from Mexican waters. So the chopper gets up, they're right above them, and the boat opens fire on Border Patrol. And
wrong answer.
What basically happens is the next day we're having a debrief about this and we're talking about it. And it was really fascinating to see the regime change right there while we were there. And what ended up happening was our pilot, Chopper Bob, he was like, all right, well, I'm going to make it real easy for everybody. Anybody who's on board my chopper is authorized to fire if somebody's firing back at another law enforcement entity to protect those guys. And his co-pilot was like, but sir, they could fire at us. And he's like, yep, they could fire at us. So welcome aboard, sailor. It was like, dude, that guy's eyes, literally, it was like he had something grown out of his forehead that we have down at our wave line. Like his eyes were just like, oh my gosh. Like, it's not the answer he wanted to hear. He's like, but we're like JP5 in the air. And then they get into a little argument where the chopper goes, well, look, man, I'm not going to sit there and watch I get hurt when there's something I could do about it. And you know what? I don't care if we get shot at. And if we get shot out of the sky, we get shot out of the sky.
Right.
He looks at him and he goes, that's why we went to dunker school. And I was like, Sweet. Can do that in a helicopter. I'm like, this is like, mind you, you know, like if you ever read a MLEM manual, it's like very rarely do you ever deal with like choppers, right? But it always like the pilot in command has authority over whether your weapons will be loaded or not loaded. And I'm thinking, dude, just the fact that we're on a helicopter with loaded guns is cool. Let alone this guy just said he literally will authorize to shoot out of a helicopter. I'm just like, this guy's awesome.
Yeah,
this guy's
for sure.
Like, you know, he's like, we might as well be up here all wearing unicorn shirts. You know, it's like, this guy's awesome.
Right.
So, yeah, so we had a great crew. They get a call one night where, now mind you, our unit was not to be seen by anybody except on the remote parts of the beach. So, you know, National Guard had IR cams and customs and DEA and even Texas Corps drove their own trucks, even though we had a Texas Corps guy, in with us. And we get this call from Corpus and they're like, hey, customs has got this offload that's happening right now. So we run out to the helicopters, they start spinning it up. And, you know, it's like 2 o'clock in the morning. So, you know, I'm sorry, even if you're just laying there, the time it takes for you to put your flight coveralls on, your stuff on, you're zipping up, and you jump on the helicopter, and you're like, okay, I need to wake up. You know, it's not like we had time for a cup of coffee. And, you know, you're like, I need to wake up. And I just remember just that that Texas, down by the water, smell of the air. I just remember the green lights in the helicopter and some of the red lights in the helicopter. I just remember passing over where you could see the beach, and it was a good moonlight out. And the customs guy is like, hey, the offload's already happened. Like, we're heading towards Padre Island. And at that point, Corpus gets on and is like, okay, again, no problem. We were, the chopper was Thunder. Our element was Lightning, was our call signs. And the customs guy's like, hey, you know, these guys can't get out of town. So, oddly, I had jogged down that road before. So the road basically goes from at a certain point where it would go from tarmac and then, like, for 5 miles, and it would turn into sand. So I've done, like, that 5 miles and then back. And so he's now telling us, the customs guy's now telling us, like, we just hit tarmac and spring break's going on. And they were even running radars on top of some of the buildings to be able to pick up some of these boats that were out there. So this is like a huge deal. So anyhow, we come flying over, and I forget what the pilots gave for a count. They're like, hey, this is how far out we are. So, like, we're burning in as fast as possible. And the customs guy's like, roger that, blah, blah, blah. So, mind you, we hit the tarmac. So we're really, like, we're seconds behind this whole thing. But the problem now is that we're still playing catch-up, and I think our hotel, I think the Bahi Mar Hotel at that time was one of the last hotels before it went to nothing. Now, I'm sure every inch of that beach, I've never been out there again, but I'm sure every inch of that beach is a hotel. So we, when we flew out there, we were literally just above the telephone poles flying in an H-60. So we just passed our hotel. And the pilot goes, hey, Corpus, request permission to drop lightning in the street.
And you guys are like, heck yeah.
Yeah, I'm like waiting. This is like the $1,000 pyramid. It's like, things that are blue for 100, you know. It's like, I'm waiting to hear back because we in the Coast Guard know. I always love it when it's like this full bird captain's at OpCon. I'm like, nope. Probably an E5.
Yep, more than likely. Yeah.
Right, like, I'm going to be honest, I don't really, maybe a Lieutenant JG that you would have to go wake up, but pretty much it's probably an E5 and a few other people in the OpCon. Right?
Permission like, granted.
To everybody.
Right, that's awesome. But,
yeah, so I'm just like, so I there's this, like, little hesitation. Standby one, you know, thunder, yeah, roger that. Lightning can get dropped off, and we're all looking at one another in the helicopter like, holy crap.
Yeah, man.
We weren't even supposed to be seen.
Dude, that was the E3 watchstander that took the call, turned to the E5, and was like, and he's like, yeah, just go for it. That's exactly what happened right there.
But all that matters is you're covered at that point.
Yeah, right? Yeah, somebody else made the call.
We look at one another, and we're like, holy crap. I can't believe somebody just authorized this. We're not even supposed to be seen. It was like the first time we're wearing goggles, baklavas, and the Coast Guard, right? Like, the Coast Guard. So we're passing. We are radar washing the street right now. We're flying so hard to try to get there. And then they were like, I forget what the pilots did. They called the customs guy because we're all on the same freak. So they were like, hey, we're literally 15 seconds out. You know, like, if the street's cleared, we'll put lightning down. The customs guy, he was like such a Texan good old boy. He's like, I effing see you. I got you in my rear view right now. I see the light coming in. He's like, I'm doing it. I'm going to pit him now. So we're like heads out the door in a helicopter. The helicopter starts, you know how like a 60 lands, it starts like squatting that tail, and that cavitation just starts, and we are literally, this is outdoors. You're talking South Padre Island, umbrella tables, paper, because they know everybody drinks, they're drinking out of like paper cups, food service paper. It is literally just like, I remember when we would deploy on Navy ships, and we would fly with the Navy as an observer so we could run our
learn what not to do. Oh, sorry.
No, exactly. I will say two times I almost crashed in a helicopter. It was just bad luck. Bad luck.
Right.
The pilots were good. They did a good job. But I just remember like walking the deck of the aircraft carrier because there couldn't be like even a pebble on this deck. And I'm thinking, we're literally ejecting the tables that have these whatever it is, roll up little umbrella things. Like, we're injecting these things out along with most people are being radar washed. So horrible, this isn't even funny. Well, as we're cavitating down, customs blocks this car. I'm jumping out. My JG grabs me by my harness. Like, I'm jumping out. I almost got hit by a DPS car who I don't know how you do not see an H-60 about the land, but literally power slid up like underneath the helicopter. And what I was about to jump on was the hood, slant bar roof, probably roll over and bust my ass.
Right? Yeah, right. You were just going to do the slide, the hood slide right there.
Yeah, that would have looked cool.
Yeah.
Let me get something straight. That probably wasn't going to go down the way it probably would have been. And I got hit by a police car.
Right.
So, anyhow, they abort that. They go into a quick hover for a second. We're out the door holding guns, and there was DPMS was there because they were brought in on it as well. So they kind of jammed this car up. And then Army National Guard's like, dude, we still got the guys that did the offload. They're out here. So we flew out there, and that's about as far as I can go with, you know, what happened. But we had, once we were at a hover and once National Guard called us and we went back out there, then we burned back out there. But during that whole time, it was comical of everything that was flying. And I don't even know if cell phones were present like they were today. I mean, I think cell phones, I don't know if we were past the cube, that big brick phone with the little pull-out antenna, or if we just got into, like, the flip phone. All that I know is phones didn't have cameras, thank gosh, because the Admiral would have literally, the Commandant would have pissed himself. He literally would have pissed himself.
I can guarantee you.
I remember back in the Inlet days where the creation of ITD started, and the way the MLEM manual read was, we could not be present for the interrogations of United States citizens, but we could be present for the interrogations of foreign citizens. And I remember Geraldo Rivera went down to South America, and the unit was down there, and the Bolivians were drowning a guy on camera to find out where a coke lab is. And don't ask me why, because all of our uniforms had no markings. We just had regular woodland camo. None of it, like, you weren't supposed to have anything on it. But apparently somebody bumped their head that day, and there was a guy in the background, and it said U.S. Coast Guard on the so the Commandant is literally cracking his pants because it looks like, as far as you would know, it was a Coast Guard unit drowning a guy to find out where a coke lab lives. You at that point, you can't sit there and say, well, those guys were Bolivian.
Yeah, it doesn't even matter anymore. Yeah,
most of the guys all look Hispanic. Most of us all look somewhat Hispanic when we were down in South America. So, you know, I'm just thinking, just outrageous. Thank goodness our phones are not the way they are today, or we would have been in some trouble.
Well, you mentioned the Commandant whizzing himself. If he listens to this episode, he might still, the current one, might be like, oh my God, I can't believe anybody told that story.
Yeah, two decades later, right? Yeah, it's still scary. Right.
Yeah, well, the story for us, obviously, is one thing. The story of Geraldo Rivera. Like, first of all, everybody should know, you never let Geraldo Rivera with your unit, ever.
Right.
Like that's your first lesson learned right there. Can't even put that guy on the boat.
Wasn't Geraldo Rivera the one? I mean, because you did some ATOM back before you got into all the running and gunning stuff, Chris. Wasn't Geraldo Rivera the guy who did the report that discovered all the batteries we used to throw in the ocean, too, when that turned into a big deal?
You know what? He might have. And in all fairness, I will say that's a pretty shitty move on a Coast Guard.
Don't get me wrong.
Somebody did. I remember the news did, and yeah, the Coast Guard took a huge hit for that, as well deserved. You know what I mean? I don't want to ban straws like half the Democrats want to right now. Like, I'm totally good with my straw. Like, I enjoy it. I like it with certain drinks.
Right. I'm not saying we should have been throwing lead acid batteries in the water, but just to bring up Geraldo, I think that was him.
He might have.
If you're in the Coast Guard or you're listening, if Geraldo Rivera is around, run. That's what we've learned.
Yeah. I remember being up on some of those where you're just like, holy cow, you know, you're 150 feet in the air. And the worst thing was when you pulled up and it was like, it was a battery.
Oh, yeah.
Now you're hoisting that thing up. And I remember we had one off of Trip Rizzo and I, we did one off of, Mobile, and it's on I forget what those islands were called out there, but we had a chute, a range tower off one of those. And I remember climbing up that. He dropped me off on the beach. Well, when he, I say he dropped me off, like, I had to swim in. So I swim in with, like, the Aton bag over my head. I get into the beach, climb up the tower, and I've got a radio, and I'm like, yeah, the batteries are dead. He was like, sucks to be you. So I'm literally, he took a photo. I don't have the photo anymore. He took a photo of me walking to the boat because he could not get in any further. And a wave goes over, and all you see is the battery above the water, and you don't even see me.
Nice.
And I think I had to do that three times. So I get him, you know, give him one battery. He gives me another battery, go up there, and absolutely.
And I was going to say, for anybody who's listening who's never had the joy of Aton in their life, when Chris and I are talking about batteries, these aren't D cells. We're talking about, these are car batteries that you're carrying over your head through the surf.
Yeah. Yeah, they're pretty heavy. I forget about that.
Ugh, batteries. Aton. You're hurting my soul right now, Bill.
Hats off to guys that love doing Aton or MSO, especially MSO. I mean, like, you're a by-the-book guy. You can't be anything else but a by-the-book guy if you're working at the MSO. You know what I'm saying?
I mean, if your wall is full of the Code of Federal Regulations in, like, hardback copies, like, yeah, you're a by-the-book guy for sure. Rough duty. Well, hey, Chris, so Tackle It North has now, like, transitioned to the Maritime Security Response Team, right? Were you a plank owner back then?
No, the only thing, so when I was at Tackle It, we were counter-narcotics the whole time, except we had the Persian Gulf, we went to the Adriatic, and the cool thing about the Coast Guard was Bill Clinton, during those years, the Coast Guard, well, let me rephrase that. The U.S. military could not do anything except what they called monitor and detect. Now, I'm sure the special operations community, after my job being at Applied Marine Technologies and talking to those guys, you know, those guys were dealing with the Bosnia stuff. But let's put it this way, big military could only monitor and detect. Now, the interesting thing was we flew over there, because obviously the Coast Guard has a unique ability of finding things on board ships. Like, that's our bread and butter. All of a sudden we walk in and we're like, hey, this has got a low overhead, or hey, this tank doesn't make sense, it's not sounding right, or this looks like a hidden compartment, or this has fresh paint, or who just touched these bolts with a wrench. And of course we're good in our detective work, because, you know, we'll just casually ask one person and then get a different story from another person, and all that, you know, leads to reasonable suspicion, which is, you know, goes to probable cause, and then, you know, we just start doing what we want to do. But over there, a lot of the guys don't have the expertise to find weapons and or people that don't want to be found because they're of a terrorist background in nature. So we would deploy over there on Navy ships. The Navy ship would get us to where we would do boardings with the Turkish, the Dutch, the Spanish, the Italians, the Brits. And we would go over under the Mansfield Amendment, which allows us to go on as technical observers. And the great thing was, the reason why we could do this was we were Department of Transportation. So when we were in South America, when we were doing counter-narcotics, when we were overseas in the Adriatic, we were all doing that under the hat of DOT. So we could still do the same use of force, deadly force. We didn't have any arrest authority, but we could go on with a foreign entity and go take down a ship and assist them in that and help them in that particular mission. When I was in the Persian Gulf, then I was over there under DOD orders. So we had obviously a different policy when it came to, we're not following our normal use of force, deadly force program. We're under ROEs at that point, rules of engagement. So people just don't realize, like, shit, we actually wear three hats. We're customs and border agents when need be. And then we're also, at that time, we were Department of Transportation, so we were federal law enforcement officers. And then, of course, you know, when in time of war or anything else going on, we're DOD. So,
Right, and then there's the whole back end to it too, right? Like the whole, you know, the licensing, the documentation. I mean, basically, if it happens on the water, it's the Coast Guard for sure. Some way, shape, or form, the Coast Guard's involved.
True. Now, you had brought up the transition. So a awesome individual, which was Lieutenant Commander Rodriguez, he had started shit when he was in. The ITD had a merger. It was DIOT, Drug Interdiction Assist Team, down in South America. Now, this is back when the U.S. didn't care, and we were throwing Army units down there, the SEAL platoons down there. We didn't, like, I'm sorry. If people think we follow Posse Comitatus, they're so mistaken, it's not even funny. But in certain times, the U.S. will just throw a military asset. So you're talking the drug wars going on, the Pablo Escobar days, the late 80s, snowcap, and we're talking about throwing in Coast Guard and Army and Marine Corps along with the Navy as well down in South America. And I mean, shit, there's things that have happened in this country that you got what looks like an FBI or a police unit that goes, hits a structure, rescues everybody, and goes to an airport as soon as they're done and leaves. And all the credit goes to that police, particular police department, because at that point you need a certain breed of individuals that know how to do a certain thing. And we don't care. Like, we don't care about Posse Comitatus. And I'm glad we don't, for those particular circumstances where we use a military unit to conduct operations in the United States for the greater good of America. Right. So I'm glad we have leadership that performs that. So we had great leadership there. And then Commander Rodriguez, him and I bumped into one another. I was at Tacklet North. He was at Tacklet South. And then he was our commanding officer when I was teaching at MLE school. And then at the time, all the MSSTs came up. Well, Tacklet North was tasked to create a battle roster port security unit for the Olympics back in 96, because the Olympics were going to be in Savannah, Atlanta, and Tennessee. And we were at a Savannah because a skiff boat racing was out of there. So then they sent us to get PSU qualified, because remember, a port security unit back then had to be called up by the president because they were a reserve unit. And well, that was really going to happen.
Did you go to PSU school?
Yeah, we went up to, know where it was.
What was it, basic skills or something? Cold. Is it like basic skills course they called it?
I don't know if it was Michigan or where it was. I just know that being from Virginia and Florida, it was horribly cold and my feet were horribly frozen. And, of course, boat guys have to do both land tactics and water tactics. So, like, we're doing it both while the land guys were, like, just the land guys to protect the PSU unit. So we were literally... it was for about 3 years. We were a battle roster port security unit. Now, it got disbanded. So I was a plank owner, and I had left Tacklet just before it got closed down. But then 9/11 happened, and then they created the MSSTs. And I'm like, man, do I want to go to ITD and go to Ghana, Africa, Republic of Georgia, Albania, you know, French Guyana, Trinidad and Tobago, and then, you know, I finished up down in Iquitos, Peru. Or do I want to just go tow a boat around and do port security unit around a cruise line? You know, like I already did part of that mission for the Olympics, which was way cooler than what those guys have to do, you know, escorting ships into a harbor. You know what I'm saying? So the MSST got created. Commander Rodriguez was pushing to have and hopefully people don't freak out about this, but basically a mini dev group. And the reason being is because dev was off slaughtering people in Afghanistan and Iraq. So you had the teams deployed, and then whatever team came in for a short period of time, you know, man, that was like a 1 hour spin up to get on a plane to go wherever a problem is. And the Coast Guard really stated that they had this capability, honestly, laughably, the equivalent of DEV, that we could respond with a similar unit in CONUS. And that was not true. And Commander Rodriguez basically stood up this whole unit, and a lot of help came from Naval Special Warfare Development Group to be able to hook and climb, to be able to do this mission, because it was time sensitive. Because we're talking about nowadays, you cannot give terrorists time to fortify. So, like, if there's a report that something's going down, like, you got to literally start dropping guys on to create problems for them to where they can't set up and make it any more complicated than necessary. Like when you look at the theater in Moscow and a Bethlehem school siege, you cannot allow those terrorists time to fortify. And you're talking about tier one units that are for the greater good. They're fighting something overseas constantly, you know, and it was really hard to get a team to be able to spin up that quick, where the SRT, or I think it was the SRT, and then it turned into the dog. Like, who picked that name? But to be punched in the face. That's where the Coast Guard was trying to go, because the Coast Guard made some promises to Congress that, hey, we have this capability. And people were like, no, by no means do we have this capability. By no means do we even have the right boats to be hooking and climbing. Or the right equipment to hook and climb. So that was all taught by, you know, the SEALs to the Coast Guard to be able to at least get an asset on board to start disrupting whatever was going on.
Yeah. We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT. And I think the money was there too, you know, like to maybe a little domestic power grab kind of to at least try and tap into that money,
right,
so that you could create the teams and start building it up. So if you say you got it, then they got to fund it, right? I would guess that probably played a factor.
Yeah.
But those are by no means like easy tasks either. I mean, hook and climb is a very resource and personnel intensive, you know, evolution. And especially if you combine aviation.
If you looked at the Achilles Laurel when that went and got taken, when you look at dev groups, like one of the things that people don't realize when we're talking, you know, 15-foot seas and 40-foot, like, was the max. I mean, you know what we know what 15-foot seas are. Like, that's insane. Climbing down
the
ladder. That means if you got released on the bottom of the ladder, you better freaking climb fast, because a 15-foot swell's coming. And it's hard to climb a cave and ladder that fast. And you're talking about pneumatic poles. You're talking about, you know, hell, the question hook, which looked like a big question, that was carbon fiber. You could put 3 assaulters on the ladder at the same time on the tip of that thing. And that thing was like $5,000 or $7,000 just for that. That's not even the ladder, you know. So, I mean, so much to learn from guys, you know, and that's our thing. Like, we've never been afraid to learn in the Coast Guard. We've never been afraid to say, you know what, I don't know that. Like, I'm sorry. Like, what do you, like, show me. Like, we're humble guys. You know, if this is your forte, if this is your bread and butter, if this is what you do, and we got to go do that mission, then to be honest, like, we want to be the best at it. And in fact, as soon as you're done showing us, we want to be better than you at it. And it's not because we have ego. It's because we take it that serious. And I think that's the uniqueness that the Coast Guard has, is that, like, you know what? We don't know what all the other branches of the military do. And we are not all the, I mean, you look at what one of our boats get underway with. I mean, you know, when you sit there and you're like, hey, we've got a 41-foot doing search and rescue with a BM3 as a coxswain, the one in charge, with maybe an MK3 and then maybe a seaman on board to do SAR, like, and we're 20 miles offshore. No other branch of service does it. I remember pulling up to the naval pier in a 55-footer, and the chief comes over, you know, very nice naval chief comes over. And he's like, hey, who's running this boat? And it's like, I am, chief. And he's like, he looks down at my collar, and he's like, I'm sorry, who's running the boat?
You're right. Who's the boat officer again?
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, here we are doing counter-narcotics off a Navy ship, and they're telling us they can't take seven of our guys on a 25-meter rib. And our BM-1 looks over at him, and he goes, sir, can I talk to you for a second? You know, and we're within earshot, but he, you know, pulled him, you know, aside enough to be respectful. And he's like, how come all seven of our guys can't go over on this boarding? And he goes, how many guys are in the boat, sir? And he goes, well, there's the coxswain. That's one. Okay, makes sense. Got to have a boat driver. There's a boating officer.
Right.
Stands there. I don't know what he does, but I guess. Because, I mean, technically the coxswain's in charge. When you hold that coxswain call, I could have a full bird captain telling me, I don't think that's a good idea. And I go, sir, at the end of the day, I'm the one qualified on a boat. No disrespect, but it's my ass, not your ass, on the line. Right? So then they had a boat engineer. Well, that's another good one to have.
I think a Navy coxswain is more like a helmsman. You know what I mean? Under the boat officers.
Right.
Yeah.
You're right. It's not like us. We're a lot different in our stuff. But in all fairness to them, you know, I'm like, I got a boat driver and I got a guy who fixes it. Plus the officer, that was already three. They had a bowman to take off the bow line. They had a sternman to take off the stern line. They had a rescue swimmer as well, and a signalman. And we're all running radios in it's daytime. So I'm just like, listen, can the engineer take off the bow line? Let's just hypothetically say that the rescue swimmer, I don't have a problem with him being on board. Can he take off the stern line? And can we get rid of everybody else? So I just need the rescue swimmer, the coxswain, and the engineer, and we're good. Like, we got enough. And, you know, finally they let it happen. But, I mean, that's big Navy for you, right? I mean, that boat was getting underway with like six dudes on it already, and I'm just like, can one guy do another guy's job? So we've always, like, we always, you know, I remember being in a 110. We were doing some fisheries boardings after some incidents has happened, and we had to go just get back into the normal Coast Guard, is what our command said. And I was like, there were two females just driving a boat. And I remember thinking, like, you will never see this anywhere else. There are two qualified females on a 110 up at the bridge right now, and nobody else is up here. I'm like, that's awesome. You know what I'm saying?
Chris, you were telling that Navy story. You know, you ruined some ensign's OER because literally the only thing he did was being the boat officer. And you took his job away from him.
That's true. The fact that he would have wrote that into his oath, like, should make you just want to vomit into it. So,
well, and I would echo, man, I think that thing you said earlier about the Coast Guard being humble and being willing to learn these new missions. I mean, we get saddled with a ton of new missions, it seems, you know, annually almost, right? Like, something new comes up and it's like, hey, you guys are responsible for it. But I think they, you know, beyond being humble is, we basically, here's your tasking, right? And now it's your responsibility to make sure it works. So if you don't do it right, somebody dies, somebody gets hurt, you know, drugs make it in, whatever. There's a big personal responsibility, I think, that most people in the service, they take this job seriously.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, too, you know, like, when we do something that's a little new to us, that might be considered like crappy to another branch of service. Like, we think it's cool, you know, like, we like learning it. For us, it's like another qual. I mean, I remember, you know, I mean, if you think about the Coast Guard, it's like, you can only wear, I think it's like your, whatever unit you're at, that's the one pin that you have to wear. And then you wear whatever the last, whatever unit you were at when it comes to, you know, your qual. But it's like, shit, I mean, you know, if you're quad coxswain, and then at that point we're a port security unit, you know, so we had this huge coxswain looking seahorse thing, and then, you know, we had our tacklet pin, and it's like, couldn't even wear all of our pins. Like, other branches of service are geared to where, as you're making and doing your stuff, you always continue to add to your uniform. We're like, well, no, like, it's got to be your top two, and just take the other two and just put them in a box for right now. you know, I mean, I remember when I left, I had 7 rows of ribbons, you know, because we were volunteering for everything. And of course you're at units that are just constantly, you know, constantly doing that kind of stuff where, you know, you're going to get a NATO pin, you're going to get a combat, you know, pin, you're going to get a Southeast Asia pin. We're always just volunteering for stuff, or you're always getting, you know, tasked with stuff. So, I don't know, man. I mean, I did like the Coast Guard. I enjoyed it when we had our Vietnam era guys in there, because they didn't care. Like, they didn't care about their whether they were going to make rank or not, you know, and upset somebody. And then when the risk aversioners got in there, like, that was a really kind of tough time. And then the Coast Guard started changing because of what was going on. And I think now they're probably in an in-between. You know what I'm saying? They're probably in a good in-between where, you know, we're still in an aggressive service, not as aggressive as I would like to see, especially for our guys and what they intercept and everything else. But, you know, they're doing the best they can.
Yeah, I think it's probably a good summary of it. About in between. What do you think, Bill?
Yeah,
in between?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think we're in a good place. Kind of, we're not at either extreme end of the pendulum. You know, I had a CO say one time, the Coast Guard has an incredible amount of authority, and one of the ways we kind of protect that authority is by making sure we don't abuse it. So sometimes we're maybe a little less aggressive than we could be, maybe a little less out there than we could be, but that helps us protect that authority to be able to not get it taken away from us because we don't use it stupid. We use it smart when we do use it.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I told my son's on a 87 footer out of Panama City.
I love it, man. Continuing the legacy.
Yeah, for real.
Yeah.
Is he third generation?
Yeah, so I guess he is.
Yeah. What rate were you, Chris?
Doing Army. My other son's in the Army. He's doing like crypto intel out of a certain location.
I knew you were going to say that, man. At an undisclosed location. I love it.
For the government.
Yeah,
even if I mentioned a base, and generally everybody knows, like, okay, then he's working here. But so he's like super smart, always has been. You know, kind of kid who's, you know, goes in and starts playing piano, and the guy comes up to me and we're looking at buying a piano for him, and the guy's like, you know, so how long has your son been playing the piano? And I'm like, about, you know, I guess 10 months. And the guy's like, oh my gosh. He's like, you know, who is he trained with? And I'm like, YouTube.
Like, yes.
Just watched it. He's like, does he read music? I'm like, nope, doesn't even know how. He just does it all on sound, you know, and does in quad cubes and fixing them, and he could do them blindfolded and everything else. And he's in the Army. My other son, that's in the Coast Guard, it's been interesting because the ME rate right now is like 2 years. They've cut the school off right now. So he was going to apply for it. And then he's like, man, you know, it's like, I don't know whether I want to do that or not. And now he's talking rescue swimmer. And I'm like, that's the job for you. Like, you will literally stay in the Coast Guard your whole entire career and past. Into your, like, you will be like 50 when you get out of the Coast Guard because you'll love that job if you just do the, you know, rescue swimmer. And so he's training for it right now. His skipper on his 87 is, you know, kind of like that athletic type, so it really helps. And talking about, you know, hey, maybe sending him over to Navy dive school right there, that's at Panama. And I really hope that's the route he goes, because I think that's what he's bred for. I don't want to see people, you know, I don't want my kids doing exactly what I did. I want them doing what makes them happy. So, he's realizing, he's like, I got to train because it's like an 85 to 90% fail rate, you know, at that school. So the Coast Guard doesn't screw around with definitely with the aviation side of rescue swimmer. That's for sure. Especially with a, you know, 85 to 90% fail rate. Sometimes out of a class of 30 to graduate 2, it's like, Like, holy cow.
When that's, you know, yeah. Man, like, you got to think, too, like a Coast Guard rescue swimmer, that's a duty standing job for, you know, 2 decades almost. Like, 2 decades in a helicopter. That's brutal. But an awesome deal, right? I wish I was still staying in duty every day.
True, but you're talking aviation too, and I mean, you know,
it is cake too. You're right. There's a give and take. That's like,
huge. You know,
I told him. I said, "Hey, man, aviation officers completely different than ship officers."
Oh yeah, sure.
You're gonna have to remember to. Your biggest problem is gonna be because you're calling them Brian and Jack and Chris and everything else. I'm like, you're gonna have to remember, like, hey, you know, as soon as that bird lands, you know, throw your salutes and yes sir, no sir. I was like, because that community is completely different than the ship community. So though the tempo might be a little aggressive, you know, hey, those guys want to look good doing it. So they're a different breed.
That's true. Hey, we never got into it, Chris. What was your rate? Or rating?
I was a bosun mate.
BM, all right. So, and then your dad was a BM too, right?
Yeah, so, you know, dad was a BM, and then he retired in 1988. My uncle was also a bosun mate. He, my dad retired from St. Pete Aids to Navigation. My uncle retired as a chief from Station Port St. Lucie. My grandfather was in the Navy, and then he worked for the Concordia Company out of Massachusetts. So he was a ship rigger. So it's like we've always had this maritime background. My wife, she was a Kings Point Merchant Marine grad. She was an officer in the Coast Guard. When she finally got out, she was a lieutenant commander. And so we've always had this, like, maritime history, so to speak. So when we started our own company, a lot of people, well, not a lot of people, but some people were upset because I was using a Trident. And they were like, well, the Trident's like a Navy SEAL thing. And I'm like, actually, it's not. It's one of many things that the Navy SEALs use on their Budweiser. Which is an Eagle Globe anchor and a musket rifle along with the Trident. I'm like, they get a lot of crap going on. I was like, but you do know that in maritime, just in general, you know, just if you look at maritime, you'll always see a Trident. I'm trying to think back to like any pin I had that didn't have paddles or a seahorse on it or Tridents on it in the Coast Guard. So I'm like, you can't just say that's for Navy SEALs. And I'm not trying to be a Navy SEAL, so... You know, I was always scratching my head in my younger days. But we have on our company logo, we have the Trident, we have the net, and we have a shield. And the backstory behind our logo, so to speak, is that most of my family is all maritime. And when we were thinking about, well, we're a training company, we do some security stuff too, but we're a training company, like, well, what do we call ourselves? Cost of combat, cost of defensives, like, I don't know, some other tactical something. And the gladiators, that we don't advertise this, like, hey, we're training gladiators or some weird crap. We say that the school was Ludi, which was L-U-D-U-I, was a school that gladiators went to. And there were a lot of different types of gladiators. There were net guys, net fishermen. There were the Retarius, and the one group used a Trident, net, and shield to fight during the games. And Ludus was the training that they went through. So technically, we're Costa Training, but it reads Costa Ludus in Latin. And then that's how we came up with our Trident, our net, and our shield. And the Trident was more representation of the, hey, we're always around water. That's our history. Our family's been around the water for so long. And
dude, Chris, I think so. Two comments, man. I think the logo is sweet, by the way. It's awesome. And like, I mean, you can immediately tell that you're, you know, it's kind of harking back to those gladiator training days. And I think, you know, with your background post Coast Guard, maybe you'll tell us about it in a minute, definitely fits. I'd just say you got some prima donna haters out there somewhere, if that's what they're thinking of.
It used to be, but now, and you know why? It's because there was a Coast Guard guy in the firearms community teaching, and that's really what it came down to.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, man. Yep.
Right.
Nowadays, we set the you know, the all the barriers that we broke through is where other people now that some of which don't even have any military or law enforcement backgrounds. I mean, I'm still active in the law enforcement community. I have been since probably 2010 with the Sheriff's Department. And it's we've just kind of created this wave where, you know, if you can teach people how to shoot, you can teach people how to shoot. You know, because if they couldn't get rid of me, they're not really going to get rid of you, type of deal. So,
yeah, and I think, man, you were, you know, you probably got out. You were basically at the foundational level of the Coast Guard taking on like a more high end mission. And I would say it's only professionalized since you got out. You know what I mean? Like you basically laid that groundwork, and I don't think too many people would really dispute the capability that the Coast Guard now has and some of the skill sets that they've been able to develop. I mean, there are some shooters, you know, like these guys are putting rounds, you know, tight groups all day long at speed and everything else.
Look at the Coast Guard, you know, like how amazing the Coast Guard, I think this year, was it last year, where they just won the International Sniper Comp?
Right.
Like, the United States Coast Guard just won the United States, you know, the International Sniper Comp. Do you know who they went up against? And, you know what the great thing was when I was going to shoot in schools? And I remember I spent probably over 60 days with SEAL Team 2 various times, going through all their training because, well, we didn't shoot the way they shot, and we didn't really know how to shoot because we were like most cops, where it's like we have a qual, we do our qual, we can carry the gun, and that's it, right? We don't have like shooting schools that we go to where you're doing CQB and boardings and breaching and everything else. So I attribute a lot of my shooting and being awoke to some of the great warrant officers that allowed us to have orders cut to them to do what they do and fall in. Now, did that make you a Navy SEAL at the end of the day? Nope, not at all. It just made you a Coast Guard guy going through training that people that were better than you were at. But the one thing that I loved about the Coast Guard was if you sucked, well, everybody would just look at you and be like, well, what do we expect? He was a Coast Guard guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But you did awesome. So there was, I love starting from like a low expectation.
It was a win-win for you, right?
You have to win. Like if I'm shitty, well, what am I, Coast Guard guy? Like, all right, you know, like what were we expecting from this guy? But if I'm awesome, then I was like, damn, I'm the Coast Guard guy. And I remember a guy named, I think it's Herschel Davis. He used to be on all these old documentaries. He was a Navy SEAL. He had this big handlebar mustache. He was a big kind of like mammoth of a guy. And we were at Blackwater, and we were going through some training. I had my USCG federal law enforcement officer shirt on. And we're running MP5s on Rogers Range, like knocking down plates and everything because they have this like laptop. Rogers got this like awesome system, and Blackwater had it at the time. It was before Blackwater got all weird and stuff. He was out there, and we start running some competitions. So I come in second on one, I come in first on the other, and he goes, and mind you, like if I did it, I would just like literally go walk off, go load mags. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's it. Like, consider myself lucky. Let's stop there. Let's be humble, and that's it, right? And
right,
I'm only one guy.
Smack.
Yeah, I'm no smack talking, no like, yeah, you Navy SEALs, like, don't say crap. They outnumber you. I don't want to get choked out, right? I don't want to drink my own urine. Just, like, just go back, just load mags, right? Like, we'll call that, like, oh, how did that happen? So I come in second on one. I come in first on the last drill, and then Herschel's like, he's like, I can't believe you guys got smoked by a Coast Guard. I was like, whoa, whoa, no. I mean, if you look at the times, they were so close, so close. I mean, like, Brian almost won. I mean, like, it was just, I'm just like, oh my gosh, please do not do what you're doing right now.
Right.
Like, do not create animosity. Like, I got to go and do room entries over in a two-story kill house in an hour, and that's just going to be horrible.
Yeah, you're like, and it's live fire. I don't want to catch one in the back.
No, worse, it was Sim, and they would just be like, hey, Coasty.
Yeah, right.
Boom. Yeah, you can be number one. And I was like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Damn you, Herschel. But yeah, that's a great thing about our nature is that, hey man, we want to learn. You know, we're not afraid to raise our hand and say we don't know, and but that has nothing to do with me. That's us as a branch of service, the men and women that are in the Coast Guard. They're just that kind and caliber of people. You know, I mean, I used to, you know, we used to always tease the Navy and be like, well, you know, the reason why you weren't in the Coast Guard is because we have a really, you have to meet a certain, at least ASVAB score to get in.
Right. Guard. We so, still use that.
But, yeah. So I'd like to at least say, especially when everybody's like, well, the reason why you're not in the Navy is because you're so short and you didn't, you know, so I was like, oh, okay. But we got great men and women that just do spectacular things on a regular basis who like don't even get recognized. And if they get recognized, it's on like a base level or whatever, a command level. It's like not even talked about again, you know. So it's and at the end of the day, we don't even care. Like, we don't even care. It's just a chapter in our life, and we turn the page and we're in another chapter.
Well, that's – hey, Chris, maybe that leads us into this. So the first time I ever heard your name, right, was when I was at Miss Miami, and we were all – you know, everybody's starting to shoot, right? Like, the shooting's getting progressively – it's more than just that every six-month qual period. And I saw you with Magpul Dynamics. I think it was, like, Art of the Carbine or something like that. But that's where I first saw your name. How did you kind of make that transition? Was that something that you wanted to do after ITD and the Maritime Law Enforcement Academy? Like, where did you just realize your love as a trainer then?
I think the Coast Guard started making me enjoy training that I didn't catch on to when I was at Catholic, because we trained a lot of international guys and we trained a lot of U.S. Navy. And I will say, I thought I was a good teacher when I was at Tacklet, and when I got to MLE school, they created a billet for me because they hadn't had any E4s there as use of force instructors or just any E4s there in general. So they had to take a BM1 billet away, and they created an E4 billet, and my commanding officer talked to the lieutenant commander, and I've always been very blessed and very fortunate. So, nevertheless, I remember my master chief. I wish I remember his name. He was very pinnacle with CGIS, and then he was doing, I guess that was his last tour, was MLE school. And he was one of those guys where, you know, one of the first things in any type of curriculum, they always say, hey, give your bio. Right. Give your bio in class and then start. Hey, we're going to talk about use force, deadly force today. Right. This is why I'm here. And if you heard my background, I'm fully qualified to be teaching you, type of deal. So I get through like my background and, you know, he lets me do it. And he goes, hey, let me ask you something. He goes, whenever you hear somebody talk about their background, like a cop or another Coast Guard guy or whatever, he's like, you ever tune them out? And I was like, what? He goes, you ever hear them talking so much about themselves that you just tune them out and you don't even really care? And I was like, well, yeah. He goes, you have an amazing background. He goes, do you want people to be curious about you? Or do you want to tell everybody everything about you? Or do you want your teaching to show people, holy cow, like, this guy's amazing. Like, I want to know more about him. He goes, because there's kind of a few paths that you could take on this. So we had that talk, and when I walked into a room, I never even told anybody. You wouldn't know whether I was at tackler or anybody else. I just would be like, hey, my name's Chris Costa. Today we're going to talk about use force, deadly force. Why are you here? Do you care about this class? Is it important? Just give a shit, you know, like, why are you here? And that really straightened my my rudder, so to speak, especially being, you know, and being humble, where at that point, you still got me?
Yeah, we still got you.
Yep. Yes,
yeah, I like this, man. This is interesting. Yeah, this is like...
At that point... sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Somebody was calling in.
No, you're good.
But we're basically... I think the first start of, thank goodness somebody was keeping my ego in check. And I pretty much stayed that way my whole time. When I went over to ITD, there were stellar performers over there. I mean, we're talking just like, again, between Tacklet and when you looked at MLE school when I was there and when I was at ITD, you're talking about just like tip of the spear individuals, like such good individuals. And I will also say that everybody that outranked me, which was pretty much everybody, just such good leadership, like such good leaders, to where you know you got a good leader when you want to emulate them. You know what I'm saying? When you're like, man, one day I hope I'm just like them. And when you have, when you're surrounded by those people and that's your tribe, it's just awesome. So when I got out of the Coast Guard, I had earlier, before I went to ITD, I tried to join a company called Applied Marine Technologies out of Virginia Beach. And we did a job interview. I met the guys at a restaurant. And basically, they were like, listen, you need to do some more international stuff if you can. We don't know if you can. We don't know how the Coast Guard is. I said, actually, I can. They said, you need to get some more schools underneath your belt. And we can't guarantee a job at the end of it, but it'll help your resume. So, you know, 3 years later, after ITD, you know, I put down my resume again. I'm right at that pinnacle turn, and I get hired. And I'm the only Coast Guard guy there at this company. And everybody that was there, I mean, we're talking Grenada guys, Panama guys. You know, we had chem bio people working on systems that would detect whether or not, you know, a chem bio plume in New York went off and which way it was going. So fire could open up a laptop and right at the cutting edge of when all this stuff started. We had a guy named Josh Van Halen building robots, and Bill Shepard, the astronaut, running. They were running Stockworks, and all these guys that were just amazing, like the most amazing human beings you've seen. Like, I mean, just Silver Star, Bronze Stars. Just this is the caliber now that I'm surrounded by, and I'm just a Coast Guard guy, right? And again, these guys, if you met them, they would probably, at our company at the time, you know, probably walk up to you with a pair of shorts and flip-flops and, you know, a collared shirt, and they'd be so curious about you. Like, you would not know any of their backgrounds. You wouldn't know how many knife kills they got, how many people they shot in the face. Like, they didn't walk around acting tactical. They were just very humble individuals. And I feel that if it wasn't for that Master Chief, I think his name was Nate something, I can't remember, but if it wasn't for that, I might have walked into that company with an ego and not gotten hired. And the interesting thing was, it was like a couple of years later, we were doing some hiring, and there's somebody that gets assigned to whoever's applying for a job that's kind of past certain phases. And then that person escorts that person through our building. And then unbeknownst to me, the handler comes back and kind of goes, hey, thumb up or thumb down, what did you think of that guy? And I'm in the office, and they're like, some guys were like thumb down, some guys were like thumb up, and so on and so forth. And I was like, wait a minute, dude. I was like, that guy was with you over at Dev Group. And he's like, you just gave him a thumbs down? And they're like, he has too much ego. And I was like, what? And they were like, yeah, he's a good soldier. Don't get me wrong. Like, fucking kill the shit out of people. But at the end of the day, he's going to create conflict here. And we want people that are like us, right? And I'm like, hey, so when I walked through here a couple years ago, and they were like, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And when we asked you questions on what you did and you just kind of played them off like they were no big deal, that's the only reason why you get this job. And I was like, you know, like, you just, thank goodness for that, Master Chief, right?
Yeah,
so, man. Around a bunch of other sure. people that have done bigger and better things than me, but at the end of the day, they don't show it either. So just greatness.
And then did that transition to Magpul? Like, how did that come around?
Great question. So I went down to Florida. We were teaching a counterterrorism contract, a shooting contract, CQB. And I was trying to make the qual course harder because I believed it was too easy to pass the shooting course. And the Navy was trying to make it easier. And at a certain point, I felt that we're as senior leadership, we're signing off these guys, saying that these guys are ready to go and do this mission. And you're telling me I'm signing my name to something that not only do I think the qual can be fudged in some places, I'm trying to make it harder. The Navy was trying to make it easier. So I bumped into Magpul. We were doing a thing. I was helping them out. We at AMTI was helping out another company called TDI, which were building the Chris Super V. And the reality is that Magpul built that Chris Super V gun that you see today. Like, we built that gun from what looked like a snorkel with a pair of ordnance magazine and a cock sticking out of it, like a spray nozzle on a hose, to where Magpul, before I even joined Magpul, is where my relationship started with them, built this gun.
I got to Google this and gun.
Yeah, you'll know it. You can type in Chris Super V. You'll see what it looks like.
Okay.
So, I mean, they won't give credit to any of us, but we were all there. All, like, we pulled the first trigger outside a special room just to make sure that the gun didn't blow up and somebody ate it. I mean, like, yeah, the engineers at Magpul were freaking awesome. So, anyhow, we have a relationship that started, and then I went to help them with a future weapons thing that was happening back in the day where they were showcasing one of their guns, and I was going to work with the other guy to help them. And one night, me and the owner got talking. He goes, so how's everything going? And I said, good. I said, but I'm a little frustrated. I'm in a little bit of a quandary. I said, because we sign off on these guys, and I feel like if I continue to do this, blood's going to be on my hands. Like, if one of these guys gets killed, it's really my fault because I'm saying that they're ready and I know they're not ready. And he said, well, why don't you do your own thing? And I said, well, you know, like everybody, I don't have enough money to go do my own thing, and so on and so forth. And I think it was like 6 months later, when the Navy wouldn't make this course harder, I decided to get out and I joined Magpul Dynamics. It was just me. And then we started looking at doing the videos. So Art of the Carbine Part 1, Disc 2 is just me. And then once we figured out the formula, the owner, Rich Fitzpatrick, he goes, we need another character. We need somebody else. And we hired Travis. And then him and I taught literally Art of the Carbine Part 1, like, right there. Like, we never worked with one another together. We just literally came together and had that synergy and just pulled that off. And we were also teaching on, like, military doctrine. Like, him and I were still in that mode of institutional inertia where it's like, oh, we're just going to teach what we learned. And then later, by Carbine 2, we realized, like, we can do whatever we want to do because we're not in the military anymore. And we're not governed by the military and the way they used to do things. And I remember being at Jacksonville out on one of the gun ranges, and I saw a Coast Guard unit show up, and I was curious because they were shooting shotgun, and I was watching the way they were running the shotguns, and I'm like, you know what, you know, it's 2015. That was the same way I ran the shotgun. I guarantee it was the same way my dad ran the shotgun, and I certainly don't run the shotgun anymore. And if I walked over to train those guys, I would not have them do any of the things that they were doing. But institutional inertia is, well, we've been doing it this way, and this is the way we do it. And you don't go out and better your system or yourself. So
I think that's a good point, man. Right there, I think that's something that that just those videos taught me, and probably that most of that team down in Miami, I would say, was that, hey, at the end of the day, you know, it's kind of your life on the line, life of your buddies, right? Like, you do whatever you can to get better, and a lot of time that takes some independent action. So I would just thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate it, but there were a lot of people that made that happen. Sure. I was just a small part of a greater team that really pulled that off. And, you know, now when people tell me about that, I'm like, man, it's like watching B-grade porn right now. I mean, it's like so weird.
That's awesome.
You're like, am I going to see Gordon just the back of her head? But you're, I mean, I can get better on Showtime, but that's the
quote that's going on the advertising.
Oh yeah, man, that's going everywhere right there. Hey, Chris, let's
talk about.
I'm trying
to keep it family friendly. Trust me.
No, that was
pretty
good.
You can't believe the filter that's on me right now.
Well, hey, what so these days, we already kind of talked about Costa Ludus. What are you doing? How can people find you? What do you guys offer?
We work with military, law enforcement, private sector civilians. Coast Guard's got their shooting team. They had actually contacted me at some point, but they went with the same guys that's been training them. I'm like, all right, no problem. Like, I get it. But we do private contract stuff specifically for agencies. We don't advertise it. We will never advertise it. Because I don't like when I see people like, I trained this federal agency, I did this. It's like, we're all doing it so you'll spend money with us so we can be braggadocious so I can say I trained this unit. But the reality is that I don't like when you can look at my website and see that this unit is getting this training. I don't want anybody to know what training you are getting. So, anyhow, we work with a lot of military law enforcement and then civilians as well. We teach carbine. We have a carbine 1, which is fundamental class, but we fire 2,000 rounds. And, I mean, I've had master class shooters show up. I've had military guys, soft guys. It's a good class. It's a good fundamental class. If you want to learn how to run that gun, if you want to be accurate and be fast with the gun, that's, even though it says basic, that's the class that you show up to. And again, even if it says basic, you'd have to scratch your head and go, it's 2,000 rounds. We do a carbine 2, which starts getting into shoot, move, communicate. I don't teach you how to shoot. So I teach you how to shoot, move, communicate, and work with other people. And then we do a handgun 1 that follows the same routine as a carbine does. It's fundamentals, it's speed, it's reading speed, it's really controlling a lot of recoil on that handgun, trying to keep it as flat as possible. And then we do a handgun 2 that's a fighting course, which goes on worst case scenario, which is you've been shot, you're injured, you can't get up, and you got to fight from there, which means you got to draw your gun, you got to speed reload your gun, and clear all the malfunctions. So like if you're an urban prone and you're sideways, I'll teach you how to, on your right side with your left hand, clear double feed, which is like one of the hardest things to do. But that course is based on don't give up. As long as you got enough blood in your system and enough O2, and you can still work, you know, your brain and your hand, you're going to continue to fight through. Then we do CQB courses. We do vehicle courses. Our vehicle is basically 2-man, 4-man pistol and rifle. Tactics, of course, and then we do CQB, which is obviously a strict tactics course. We do maritime. They're maybe one a year for a maritime unit or an agency, a law enforcement agency that has a maritime mission, and that's everything from coxswain driving to hook and climb or to boat work or whatever it is. So, like, if I worked with the Coast Guard on it, obviously I don't need to sit there and worry about teaching a coxswain how to pull up to a moving ship. That guy knows what to do. You know, he knows how to hold station. He knows how to drop guys off. I'll give him some areas of concern because guys can get hurt and fall off and so on and so forth, and man overboard procedures. But But you know, that concentration would be more geared towards the assaulters. So those are just, you know, a few of the courses that we end up doing. We do a subgun course and a PCC course, which are pretty much the same. But now that all these pistol braces have come out, and now that all these 9mm and 5.56 and 300 blackouts are sold as pistols, it allows us to now go back to a gun that we didn't really run because an assault weapon ban never took off any bigger than what it was, because you had to be mil or law enforcement to run an MP5. So nowadays, there's all these 9mm quote-unquote pistols that are out on the market, so we have a dedicated course specifically for that. So
very cool, man. Is the wife in on it too?
She is. She runs everything behind the scenes, because if it was left to me, I wouldn't see anybody.
Right.
yeah, so, you know, teaching's my forte, and administration is certainly not my forte, but, you know, she was a prior officer, so she's good at that stuff.
What,
so.
Hey, what community was she in? What officer community? Like, what was her job?
She was on a 378, and then she was on, when she went from Kings Point Mercer Marine Academy, she went on a 378, and then she went over to the MSST out of Houston.
Oh, man, Chris, we're going to get her on one day and talk smack on you.
Yeah, for sure.
That's happening, dude.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. What? Hey, so CostaLudis.com, right?
That's correct.
Perfect. So everybody can look you up there. I know all the civilian classes are published there, right? Dates coming up and how to sign up and get on board.
Yeah, that's correct. And we just put up our 2020 schedule, part of our 2020 schedule. So
perfect, man. We'll put it out on everything that we got, all the social media, everything that they had to go out. And Chris, we so much appreciate your time today, man. We appreciate your service to the country and what you're continuing to do to develop you know, Americans and their fighting skill out there.
No, it's everybody else nowadays. They're in the hot seats. So we need to be grateful for everybody else that's out there doing the deed and carrying the flag and doing what we used to do, you know, because when we look back, it's, yeah, it's just one of those things. So it's a good thing, and it's a bad thing too. You know, it sucks when you're out of it too. But yeah, I'm trying to figure out a way to get my son's 87-foot patrol boat because of ammo allotment. And I literally told the skipper, I'll come down there for free. I'll train all your guys for free. But it's like, you know, Coast Guard and ammo, you know, how do you get like 2,000 rounds per guy? So I don't know if I need to do that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Oh, man,
like, I'm trying to get the gunner's mace, like literally shit a pickle. I'm like, dude, I got 42,000 rounds of 5.56 sitting at my house right now. I was like, that's just one caliber. Let's not even open up the door of 308. You know, I'm like, I always love it when it's like, and he had 1,000 rounds at his house and 5 guns. I'm like, well, shit, the news doesn't want to come to my house.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Like, so, anyhow.
Well, hey, man.
It was great talking to you guys.
Hey, you too.
Yeah, man, Chris, thanks for your time. Those are some awesome stories. You had some cool stuff, man. You definitely had a cool career, for sure.
Yeah, very blessed, that's for sure, with some great individuals mentoring me the whole time. And don't think I didn't get in trouble, and don't think I didn't get a foot put up my ass.
You know, I like
the nature the way I am.
I like to say, you know, failure is a great way to learn. And that, you know, everybody likes to talk about old guard, new guard, and I get what everybody says about the risk stuff. And what I worry about, that I feel like we've lost, and I hear myself getting loud. Phil's probably looking at the meter right now going, Bill, stop yelling.
No, it actually looks good. You're doing good right now.
Okay, good. Is that we've stopped embracing failure as a learning point. You know, there's times when failure is unacceptable. If you're in the middle of that fight, obviously we can't afford to fail there, but there's a lot of times when failure makes us better in the long run. And I feel like that's something we need to not lose in the Coast Guard.
Yeah, I don't think I remember. Let me put it this way. You know, I have failed my whole entire life to get where I'm at now, and it's all based on failure, that's for sure. It's certainly not
right.
Success.
Hey, Chris, you just won the award for the longest interview that we've had. You can tell I'm a total nerd and full respect
of you, man.
Yeah,
but the problem is you're probably not going to get many people watching it because they're going to be like, dear Lord,
yeah,
Jesus.
Yeah, maybe we'll cut it in half, man. But, hey, we appreciate you.
Yeah, this might be a two-parter.
Yeah, giving us so much time, dude. We really appreciate it. And
yeah, thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah. I only blew you off for like a year.
Hey, that's all right, man.
Our schedule's only like I felt so horribly bad, and I'm surprised you even had like the. I'm surprised you like gave it a chance once more when you sent that text the other day, and I was like, dude, I'm at the hotel. I got a couple days off coming. There's no excuse not to do this. So
now we know the mistake though, because you gave us a secret. We should have been calling your wife the whole time.
Right. That's
then we would have got it scheduled probably in a week.
Well, that's the expectation now, man. You got to give us, you got to shoot her our number and have her text us. Maybe she'll come on and tell us some crazy stories too.
Oh my goodness.
Well, hey, man, we really appreciate it, dude. And we wish you all the luck going forward. Let us know if we can ever do anything for you.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Chris.
We're honest, right?
Yep, for sure.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
And I think the Merced, Alabama was one of those. They will take at the time, they were probably $500,000 fountains. I bet they're pushing more than that now. And they would roll off four fountains out of aircraft with assaulters and parachute into the water. Now the boats had parachutes with hydrostatic releases on them. Release that, assaulters get in the boat, and basically if it's close enough to get little birds, then they're going to do a half bath, a helo assault force, a boat assault force, and they're going to come up and take that boat with assaulters from boats, four boats, and helicopters, if they can get helicopters in that area. If not, they're just doing it with boats.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Another one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, which delivers art by and for some daring fighters of the sea. Head over to Etsy, Facebook, or Instagram and search Always Ready Collective to check out their Coast Guard and Maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. You won't be disappointed. Anyone who gets one of their designs inked on their body will get featured on their feed and can be sent a care package on the house. Find a design you like, some blank canvas, and get it done. Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform. And like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.